Hi, everybody. If you are in the dirt, can I have somebody pass out chant books to everybody? We're gonna get just like a little thing going before we get all the way into it. Oh, and if you're in the cloud, I have a link to put in the chat. Hey, so I just put the link to the chant book in the chat. We're going to chant the harmony of difference and sameness to start things off. I actually, like I was fiddling around with this, I actually have a Mokugyo now. I will refrain from using it because it is 11 p.m. where I am and my family is asleep upstairs. So I'll lead us in it and we'll do it. It's on page five. The chant book is the first page of, excuse me, it's the first page of service A. Harmony of difference and sameness. The mind of the great sage of India is intermittently transmitted from west to east while human faculties are sharp or dull. The way has no northern or southern ancestors. The true source shines clear in the light. The wrenching streams flow on in the dark. Grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. All the objects of the senses interact and yet do not. Interacting brings involvement. Otherwise, each keeps its place. Sights vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. The four elements return to their natures just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. Eye and sight, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste. Thus with each and everything depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Trunk and branches share the essence, revered and common. Each has its speech. In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another, like the front and back foot in walking. Each of the myriad things has its merit expressed according to function and place. Phenomena exist, box and lid fit. Principle responds, arrow points me. Hearing the words, understand the meaning. Don't set up standards of your own. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Progress is not a matter of far or near, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. I respectfully urge you who study the mystery, do not pass your days and nights in vain. Well, thanks for humoring me on that, everybody. We're gonna like come back to that a couple of times in today's talk. So I just wanted to kind of do that to have it fresh in everybody's mind. If you want to hold on to your chant books, I mean, we might end up like referring to it or something like that. So yeah, this is the first for those of us that really only do Tuesdays, this is the Sangha Voices series. So Donya's on sabbatical, and we have students kind of give the talks. And so James gave the talk on Sunday because we're in August, And I guess I'm going to give the Tuesday talk, which when I signed up for it, I wasn't really didn't realize it was the first Tuesday talk. And then it also kind of snuck up on me because whoever sends out the newsletter asked me last week, like, well, what are you going to give your talk on so that I can put it in the newsletter? And so I just kind of threw it out there. Oh God, I can't even remember what I called it. Zen and quantum theory or something like that. So that's what we're going to talk about. My name is Mick. I have a professional and personal interest in sort of quantum mechanics and science. So I have a doctorate in mathematics, and when I was in my doctoral program, a lot of the mathematics that I studied and researched is I guess how you it's used a lot in sort of quantum theory and quantum mechanical systems. So and it's a lot of math. And so kind of what I want to talk about is like what we can sort of like learn from it, because these are two areas where I feel like I know some things. And so and I always see the connections between these two. I remember when I was starting in my practice, I have a tendency to overanalyze things. And so I would be sitting there, and at the time, my altar, for those of us in the cloud, I maybe this experience will resonate with you, but you sort of develop home altars, and it goes through like stages. So at the time, my home altar was like a filing cabinet turned sideways, and this big jade like Hotei, the big kind of fat laughing Buddha. That I had gotten as a joke in college. And so that was like my altar. And I remember sitting there, and I was doing zazen, and I was staring at the filing cabinet. And I don't know, I just had this moment of like, oh my gosh, I'm like, I am bringing this filing cabinet into existence. Like, this is how there's this whole principle in quantum mechanics that we'll talk about observation and all this stuff. And so I just remember like a lot of my practice has been sort of like seeing similarities between these two worlds. And I just kind of wanted to share some of it because it has brought me great joy. So yeah, quantum mechanics, well, let me back off of that phrase just a little bit. So we'll just talk like quantum mechanics is sort of what you might call modern physics. It's just what like your high school physics class just like brought into modern day. And so, you know, we've had this long struggle to make sense of our world, and it's sort of come in leaps and bounds. And we probably all remember Isaac Newton. And then, you know, the apple fell on his head, and he came up with, well, you would call it either classical physics or Newtonian physics because it was his. And what we discovered in the 1920s and 1930s was that when things get very, very small, the equations that we use in classical physics don't work anymore. And what that sort of really means is that if I took a tennis ball and I like threw it across my room, there's an equation that could tell you where that tennis ball is at any time, right? Like those are classic high school physics problem. And what we found out was is that like very, very little tennis balls, say like an electron, it doesn't behave in the same way. Those equations don't work. And so we needed this whole new field of study for like when things get very, very small. And as it turns out, general relativity, which is when things get very, very big, we also have the same problem. And so physics is offered this, I don't know if you hear the phrase grand unifying theory, but that's what physics really wants is one equation that works when things are very big. And when things are very small, and we don't know how to, we haven't gotten there yet. But I can assure you that we have built lots and lots and lots of extremely complicated mathematical structures and operators and formulations to make this to try to make this work. And so what I want to ask before we get any farther, because I feel like whenever I kind of talk about these things, I like people to engage like personally with this. And so I want to ask you a question that maybe you can almost plant as a seed before we continue. And what I want to ask you is, do you doubt the things that you see? You don't have to share it with anybody, but come up with an answer for it. You have to make a you have to give me an answer. You don't have to give it, well, don't give it to me, but you have to come up with an answer. Do you doubt the things that you see? I think it's a relevant question in life, right? Like we're going to talk a lot about science, and one of the guiding principles of science is to hypothesize and test and hypothesize and test, and that testing is all sort of about well, is all about doubt. I think we even talk about practice and how doubt can be a really good fuel for practice, right? We try to pierce through these delusions, we try to see things as they are, and that doubt is maybe a helpful tool. But I want to think about like what that doubt really means. So here's what I'll say. Like when we try to explain very basic things about the universe, things get really extremely complicated. So I don't know if you guys remember when you have an atom, right, which has a nucleus and these electrons, and they bounce around them. They orbit around the nucleus, almost like planets in the sun. But the electrons can move, right? So they go from one orbital to another. And one of the things, this is one of the big classic jumps that quantum theory makes, is that like the electron will actually move from one point to the other, but it will never occupy the space in between those two. So it will sort of go from one to the other, but it won't ever be in between those two spots. It'll be in one spot and then it'll be in the other spot. And this is a wild thing. So we come up with these like awfully complicated partial differential equations and these solutions to explain it in the same way that I have an equation to explain the tennis ball that flies across my room. Tennis ball equation's pretty simple, but our electron equation is really, really complicated. And so we surround ourselves with these complicated structures to describe some of the basic things about our existence. Like the atom is the building block for everything. It actually reminds me, when I was in high school, I got like really obsessed with existentialist thought. And Jean-Paul Sartre was one of the sort of like main existentialists, and he wrote this book, and the book was called Being and Nothingness, and he tried to describe what it meant to exist. Again, this is like a fundamental building block of things, and I will tell you that the book Being and Nothingness is like that thick, and it is really, really dense and difficult to read, and it just sort of like. One of the things that I think is maybe a theme for tonight's talk is this interplay between very, very basic things existing, like atoms, and the complicated structures that we as logical beings try to build to describe those. One of the quotes that I really like to think of constantly comes from Hamlet, and there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than exist in your philosophy. The things that we see and experience in our lives, right, are infinitely more complex and nuanced than the structures we can build to describe them. Okay. So what I want to talk about first is almost that maybe like the spirit of scientific inquiry and maybe how it's similar a lot to the way that we study Buddhism. And you know, one of the things about this is maybe what we talked about a minute ago, was like this is sort of the general spirit of inquiry that science has, right? We want to probe at the truth. And so we have the scientific method that we do to it, and we ask questions and we look, we examine, we inquire what is really here. And in science, we do this through measurement. We measure all sorts of things. We love doing that. But it actually runs pretty similar to the way that we're asked to practice. Shine the light inward, see what's really there. Not this, not this, see what's really there. And I find that really compelling. And we find out things that are maybe surprising, right? Like one of the surprising things that we found out a long ago in science is if you take something that seems very solid, it's actually made up mostly of empty space, right? Just to give you an idea of like how the atoms that make up this solid thing. If I were to make one of these atoms very, very big, and so the nucleus, which is the middle bit, if I made it about the size of a dime, the electrons, our friends that are floating out around in the cloud, would be sort of in the cheap seats of a football stadium. If I put that dime on the 50-yard line, atoms are almost entirely empty space. And yet, the things that we see and feel and interact with are not like that. And that's what we see in practice too, is that we see that the world upon very close examination tends to be very different than the world we feel like we experience day to day. And so I want to maybe like draw on that a little bit. I don't know. I'm gonna guess that not many of us are super plugged into the math world, but there is an equation. There's an equation out there, and it's called it's a series of equations called the Navier-Stokes equations. So these are differential equations that you might solve, except for we're not exactly sure how to solve them. And as a matter of fact, we're not even exactly sure that you can show that solutions exist to this equation. And it's really interesting because, so the Navier-Stokes equations, it's one of the Millennium problems, and it basically means if you can prove that there are solutions to it, again, we're not solving it, we're just showing that it is solvable. The Clay Mathematics Institute will write you a check for $1 million. Nobody's been able to come up with it. But what I find super interesting is that the Navier-Stokes equations are meant to describe the behavior of water or a fluid. And so if you were to go right now in your home and fill up your sink, water, and then disturb the surface of the water and put your hand in it, the ripples would go and the water would distort and you'd get some kind of curls, and nature, right, the world that we live in, will have calculated a solution for you immediately. Nature is almost like this grand calculator that has these solutions already. It does it. It produces that for you. And I find this relationship between sort of like theory and experience just this fascinating thing, because when we go to the theory of it, when we go to the equations, things get really difficult, really quickly, really quickly. Okay. So I think we're at the point in the discussion where I want to talk a little bit about what we mean by quantum mechanics. So there is this essential mystery, I think is probably the best way to call it, at the core of quantum mechanics. And it's this notion of particle wave duality, and we'll talk about what that means in a second. And it's a super interesting phenomenon that we discovered through scientific inquiry. And as a matter of fact, one of the most famous founders of quantum mechanics was Erwin Schrödinger of like Schrödinger's cat fame. And the Schrödinger's cat obviously is, well, just to explain it briefly, is it's a cat that you put in a box. And the idea is that the box has a vial of toxin in it. And the toxin, maybe the vial breaks and the toxin is released, and maybe it doesn't. It's chance. And so you don't know whether the vial has broken and the cat's died, or the vial has not broken and the cat is still alive. And the Schrödinger's cat part is that before you open the box, the cat is alive and dead simultaneously at the same time. It's both alive and dead until you open the box and you find out what's happened. Now, the irony of this is that Schrödinger made up that analogy as like a joke to kind of like point out how ridiculous this idea is, because it feels like the cat is one thing or another. So, but in the quantum mechanical world, what happens is you have these very small, very, very small particles. And like we had said earlier, they don't do the same things that large particles do. So if you will imagine, I'll sort of describe one of the more famous quantum mechanical experiments out there. So if I had a particle cannon and I fired it at a wall, and the wall has two slits cut into it. And then what I have on the back is it's almost like, okay, but let's imagine that it's tennis balls that I'm throwing at the wall. Let's, and then the back is like Velcro on it. So the tennis balls stick on the Velcro plate behind the slits. And as you fire these tennis balls at the wall with the two slits in it, you would expect you get like a lump over here where the tennis balls have passed through the right slit. And you get a lump over here where the tennis balls have passed through the left slit. You get two nice little bars where they've passed through each of the slits in the wall. And that's actually what you get if you watch the experiment as it happens when in the quantum world. So let's say now we fire electrons, and you'll see that on the back plate. But this is what's very interesting, is if you perform that same experiment, except for this time, as I'm firing the balls towards the wall with the two slits, I'm actually going to sort of like turn the cameras off, and I'm not going to watch it as it happens. So what I'm going to do is, after the experiment's over, I'm going to grab the Velcro plate, the back, and I'm going to look and see the pattern. And what happens when you do that, if you're not watching the balls as they pass through the slits, you get an entirely different pattern. You get essentially tennis balls that stuck on your Velcro in positions where it would not be possible for a ball to have struck it. And this is the exact same experiment, and the only difference is that you're not watching it as it happens. You don't record whether the ball went through the left slit or the right slit. And it turns out the answer, sort of like as to what's happening, is that if you don't observe these particles as they're approaching the wall with two slits, they actually go through both of them. They pass through both slits at the same time. And then what happens is you develop an interference pattern. And they'll show up sort of like in this nice, neat It's almost like a series of little bars across on the Velcro collector plate at the back. And just to get an idea of what that means for it to pass through both slits at the same time, we can imagine our wall with the two slits almost as like a seawall. And as a wave comes up to it, the wave kind of crashes into the wall. And the wave, like it's easy for us to think of a wave going through both of those slits at the same time. And then what you get is these kind of ripples that emanate from each of the slits on the other side of the wall. And the ripples, they're their own waves, and it'll sort of like they'll kind of crash into each other a little bit, right? And so where the right-hand wave is really high and the left-hand wave is really low, they'll actually kind of like cancel each other out. And that's where you don't see any balls on the collector plate. And sometimes they'll both be high and you'll see a lot of them, and they'll both be low and you'll see a lot of them. So you get this really interesting pattern. And the pattern comes from the fact that these particles are passing through both slits at the same time, and then they're interfering, not that this is the wild part, not with each other, but with itself. And this idea is that when you have a quantum particle, it is at one time, it is both a particle and a wave. It's not one and not two. It is all of these things at the same time. In mathematics, we call it a superposition of states. This is the idea of a cat being alive and dead at the same time. It's two things at once. And when it sort of first came out, a lot of people were very upset by it. A lot of people didn't understand it. This is the famous quote, when you make mathematical tools to describe this, you actually sort of leave what we would call deterministic math. So like if I throw a tennis ball, I can tell you exactly where that tennis ball is with zero uncertainty. When it comes to the quantum world, we have uncertainty. And so I can tell you maybe like probably where it is, but not for sure. And this is the famous quote from Einstein, where he said he doesn't believe that God plays dice, because the idea is that you can't tell exactly what is happening. So there's something weird with our physical universe. There's something weird about it, where us as observers, when we watch things, we pull them into existence as we understand it. If we think back to the double slit experiment, if I close my eyes and run the experiment, this quantum particle is both a particle and a wave, and it just does its thing. If I then look at it, if I observe it, if I enmesh myself into its existence, it takes the form of one of those things. Essentially, the idea is if I ask this quantum particle where it is, it will be in a place. If I ask it which slit it passed through, it will become that thing that passes through a slit. It's a particle, and I can find it. But if I don't ask it, it's not forced to be anything. And this, to me, when I first heard about the 12-fold chain of interdependent co-arising, right, which is this Indian teaching in Buddhism about how our world manifests as we see it. This is exactly what I thought. I thought, here we are enmeshed and entangled in this world, and in this strange and beautiful way, we're not separate from the things that are around us. through this act of seeing and engaging in our world, we are bringing things into existence with us. We are not separate from the particles that we observe because they are there as we observe them. When I look at my filing cabinet as I'm sitting, that filing cabinet is there because I'm looking at it. And in that way, we are connected to our whole experience and this whole world in this incredibly profound way. Two things at once, not one, not two, but together. What's really interesting to me about all of this is that, it's really difficult to kind of comprehend. It's really difficult to kind of think about. As a matter of fact, one of the first things in my quantum theory class, like on the first day, the professor kind of like came up to the podium and he was like, "Look, there's this weird thing, particle wave duality, and it's best just not to try to understand it. Just leave it. It's this mystery at the middle of things, and we'll build our math around it. And if you meet anybody who says that they do understand it, you need to run away from them because it's just not something that works with our experience of the world." And what I want to think about and kind of pick at a little bit goes back to the question that I asked us earlier, in that, like, do you doubt the things that you see? What fascinates me about this idea of the quantum world being some fundamental mystery and this unsolvable, incomprehensible thing is like reality has been what it has been for forever. When the Buddha was teaching 2,500 years ago, all of this stuff was true, right? When Dogen was teaching in 1200, all of this stuff was true. And a desk was a desk, a chair was a chair, the ground was the ground. Does your experience in the world that you walk through and go through, how could it be anything other than what it is? Does it matter if you know about quantum entanglement and this idea of observation bringing things into existence? Is that something that matters? Because your existence, your reality is what you see every day. And this beautiful interplay between wave and particle, two things at once, is happening in a symphony all around us all the time. It's the floor, it's the desk, it's the chair, it's you, it's me. It's always been doing this. It's always been singing this song. And I think that a lot of time, myself in particular, we can get caught up in the puzzle. We can get caught up in how fun it is to make equations and solve them and figure things out and think about this great mystery, when in fact, there's no mystery at all, right? Our world is our world, and it's right here in front of us. I think that for a long time in my practice, one of the first teachings that I really resonated with was the Sandokai, the harmony of difference and sameness. I thought it was beautiful and poetic, and that's why we chanted it. It has a lot of this sort of like idea of harmony between two different things. And the way that I like to think about it is the harmony between particle and wave, right? It's like the front and back foot in walking. But at the same time, the physical world, like the notion of all of these fun poetic things about front and back foot and walking, and the light, there's darkness, and the dark, there's light. That's great and wonderful. And it feels like just something about that resonates with me. But the thing that I think is lost in that, the thing that I think I have struggled to connect with, is that what Trudeau is talking about, this harmony of difference and sameness, all of these things. I mean, that is a very real phenomenon. I'm not going to say that Trudeau understood quantum mechanics on some level, but our physical reality, the world that we live in, these things that surround us is this grand symphony of difference and sameness. Right? Our practice, the teachings that we have, the interconnectedness that we feel with all sentient beings, that connection, that's a real thing. Like it's our physical world. And that's what I want to maybe think about when we think about, like, do you doubt what you see? This physical world, our experience in it, is this incredibly complex symphony of things that are extremely difficult to describe, extremely difficult to quantify through equations and measurement, and just so vastly complicated. And yet, it is the existence that we have lived our entire lives and that humanity has always lived. It is so impossibly simple as this moment we have right now. And I find that absolutely unbelievable. I find it fascinating. I have a couple more things that I thought about pointing out from the last one. This is the only one that I want to really want to hit, and then we'll maybe just sort of chat for a bit. And this one actually comes from Genjo Koan, which is Dogen's, and I'm going to see if I can find it in the. I've done it. I'm going to see if I can find it in the Yeah, let's see if I can find it. So this comes from Genjo Koan, and it's on, well, it's on page 51. When a fish swims, no matter how far it swims, it doesn't reach the end of the water. When a bird flies, no matter how high it flies, it cannot reach the sky, the end of the sky. When the bird's need or the fish's need is great, the range is large. When the need is small, the range is small. In this way, each fish and each bird uses the whole of space and vigorously acts in every place. However, if a bird departs from the sky or a fish leaves the water, it immediately dies. We should know that for a fish, water is life. For a bird, sky is life. A bird is life. A fish is life. Life is a bird. Life is a fish. And we should go beyond this. There is practice enlightenment. This is the way of living beings. Therefore, if there are fish that would swim or birds that would fly only after investigating the entire ocean or sky, they would find neither path nor place. When we make this very place our own, our practice becomes the actualization of reality. When we make this path our own, our activity naturally becomes actualized reality. This path, this place is neither big nor small, neither self nor others. It has not existed before this moment, nor has it come into existence now. Therefore, the reality of all things is thus. There are fish that would swim or birds that would fly only after investigating the entire ocean or sky. It's a complicated world out there, and I don't think anyone is ever going to figure all of it out, and yet practice realization is what we carry out right here in this moment. Okay. I feel like that's all I wanted to hit. Talk about these are the things that happen in my brain like constantly. It's just it's a mess in there. So yeah, we can sort of like open it up to any kind of questions or anything like that. Coral's gonna go first. All right, Coral.
Thank you so much for this talk. I love physics.
Welcome.
I'm super into physics. I think this is
Yeah.
really fun. So I feel like what you're getting at, well, to me, what you were talking about made me think of Ri and Qi, where right, Qi is that, well, okay, so I'll start with Ri. Ri is beyond consciousness, right? There's no, we can't understand it. It's beyond right and wrong. It's dark, right? And then the contingent G is anything we can feel, touch, think, see, taste, right? It's what comes, everything that comes into consciousness is G. And so I love that. I love that you're talking about, like, well, if it came into our consciousness, we created it. So is it, yeah, I just want to make sure that you were like, that's what you're meant to be talking about,
Yes.
the I don't really have a question, except that I think that's really cool. Thank you.
Yeah. No, and I you know, one of the things that I was gonna like in my original draft, I was gonna dive real hard into Sonikai. I'm like, well, kind of backed off of that. But like I think like you know, the Sonikai is in our translation, we translate it as the harmony of difference and sameness of that Ri and Ji. And, you know, it's about the interplay between the two of them, right? And something, and this is what I find so fascinating, is that physicists are sort of continually finding themselves pulled into this argument about observer and observed and what that means to exist, right? They're running into these fundamental issues. And to me, right, that's what that harmony is, right? It's observer and observed in this sort of like dance of bringing into existence, right? Like I exist because I observe things, and the things that I observe exist because I observe them. And neither one of us can exist without the other.
Right. And that's that, the Kai, that part that means like equality or handshake. And well, and that's the thing is, in that I was, you know, the San Francisco Zen Center is doing a thing on Shunryu Suzuki's book on the Sandokai right now. And I just to that talk before this. So it was a lovely primer for your talk.
Oh, good.
But they were translating it as the harmony of difference and equality. And I thought that was a real, an interesting difference in translation and what that meant. They didn't really
That's
go into
interesting.
it, but yeah.
That's curious. So, yeah, see, because equality to me is like two things are equal. Right, like you got an equal sign. There's like two things. Interesting. Thank you.
Hi.
What's up, Eric?
How are you doing?
I'm great.
Thank you for the talk. So I kind of took a different kind of take or lesson, I guess, from what you're saying, because if you go back to the original question you asked, do we doubt what we see? My answer was unequivocally yes, because to me, and this is my understanding of, you know, the Heart Sutra and things like that, what we see and what we observe is not reality because it's observed, because it is behaving a certain way because of our involvement to it. And it is actually reality, what is happening outside of our observation, and it is our goal as Buddhists or spiritual beings to align ourselves with that which is unseen and allow it to direct us or guide us. So I kind of took what you were saying as a different lesson that it's almost like a trick of nature to distract us from reality by letting us create stuff from our observation. So that's all.
That is beautiful, and I am so glad that you brought that up because, yeah, that to me is the other side of this coin of like reality is this thing that happens in the darkness. If we're going to get to like back to the Sanokai, right? Is that like reality is this thing that we, if we think about observing, right, immediately it's disappeared. Mountains and rivers block our way, right? And so if we just settle into it, right, and almost take this unobserved feel, is
Yes.
that the reality? Because to me, this question of do you doubt what you see? I mean, I think either way you want to answer that, give some sort of strong spiritual, like it like encourages this bodhicitta, gives you the strong spiritual inquiry, right? Because if I do doubt what I see, right, there is this deeper reality somewhere, right? If I can experience it without seeing. But if I don't doubt what I see, every moment that arises, I am here in it, right? And that's why I, you know, that's why I really really enjoy that question to kind of turn over as the world seemingly gets more and more complicated, right? It's like, do I want to chase this down? Do I want this to fuel more doubt about the things that I'm seeing and measuring and quantifying? Or do I just want to sit in it and recognize my part in it?
Ruth Ann may have had her hand up.
Oh, yes. If you were finished, Nick.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, thanks very much for this talk. I think Buddhism, especially our Soto Zen, is very much allowing us this magic of the universe as, you know, mathematically ordered, and we get this opportunity. Einstein said, in terms of the cosmos, our lives are just a blink, so we may as well see it as a work of art,
Yeah.
our lifetime. And the quote I like, I think it might be from Frank Ostashevsky's Five Invitation. You know, he ran the Zen hospice in San Francisco. Let go of your own history and embrace the mystery. And I know when I was taking metaphysics in college as a 19-year-old, you get it that, you know, things are not what you seem, what they seem, or as you see it. And I think really you learn that from life. Life teaches you that if you're paying attention. Thanks for this talk.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ruthann. Yeah, one of the things that I really particularly enjoy about Zen, I think, is this notion of sort of like simplifying. So, you know, we do have for anybody who studied sort of like old traditional Buddhist teachings, there is this 12-fold chain of interdependent co-arising where they sort of like go in excruciating detail about how, you know, we are partners in manifesting the world around us. And one of the things that sort of Dogen sort of took and sort of made almost radical was he was just like, just strip all of that away, right? It's about letting go of, like, let the mind drop away, let the body drop away, like just sit in it, right? Like we don't have to make sense of it. We don't have to peel all this stuff out. Like just see the things that are around you and be a part of them. Vince, let's do it.
Pretty good.
Andy, thank you very much. It was a great talk. I have an observation and a question. So how can you not doubt when you can have entanglement that doesn't be is not possible given the speed of light is the ultimate, limit. Isn't that true?
Yeah, you're talking about quantum entanglement? Yeah.
That can't exist if the speed of light is, actually the real limit, but it
That's
does
right.
exist. And
Yeah.
the question is, does quantum mechanics say anything about time?
T time, so the time field is really general relativity and special relativity.
Okay.
So those are sort of the big ones with time. You can because quantum particles tend to travel very, very fast, there are relativistic special relativistic like adjustments you can make for that, but most of the time questions are general relativity. Those are big physics.
Okay. Thank you.
Emily.
I also love this talk.
Great.
Thank you. And I just wanted to say the first thing that I thought of when you asked the question, do you doubt the things that you see, is that there are multiple ways of seeing things. Like there's the physical things that we see, like I don't really doubt that my like physical apartment exists, for example, or if I like see a mountain, I don't really doubt that it's there. But our consciousness is often doing all of these other things at the same time, like we're having thoughts and we're having emotions and we have all these mental conceptions of things. Which I guess I don't know that much about Zen, but really seems to be what we're getting at in Zazen and trying to let those things go and just focus on awareness itself. And a lot of those mental conceptions, I think, are things that, at least for me, I doubt what I see. And I think it's really funny you brought up Sartre because he wrote this other book that I was really obsessed with in high school called Nausea, about this guy. I see Scott laughing. It's about this guy who kind of is like wandering around having an existential crisis, and then he like sees a reflection of himself in a mirror and is like, oh my God, like, is that what my face looks like? And it's just that's like a book of it goes on for like 300 pages, just like that. Or he like sees a piece of paper in a pond and he's like, oh my God, is this our disgusting reality that we live in?
Yeah.
So yeah, I really liked the way that your talk kind of made me think about how there are different types of things that we see. And then also this idea of in quantum mechanics, by observing something, you kind of fundamentally change it. And just all the ways that just by existing in the world and perceiving it, we are changing it all the time. Whether it's like physically, like moving air as we breathe it in and out, or on different levels, like how if you have a friendship with someone or a relationship with someone, you're both kind of changed or shaped by that experience. So this is a really cool talk. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So I am reminded, what you said reminded me of this principle that Domio talks about a lot of our mental map, right, of the universe. And we have this mental map that helps us make sense of the things that are around us. And to me, that's sort of like what we bring to our experience in reality. That's us labeling and trying to make sense of the things around us. And where it gets really confusing is where the mental map stops and where reality starts. And this is the thing that I ask my calculus students every semester. We got another one coming up here in a couple of weeks. I ask them if calculus is something, is it something that people invented or is it something that people discovered? Right? Is there some reality to the mathematics that we have to describe our world? Is that mental map or is that reality? And I think that's one of the questions that we really get at in Zazen, right? It's like, what part of my experience is coming from within and what part of it is here? And I think the great fascinating thing about physics is that it's both, right? Like you can't separate the mental map from reality. Like you can't separate observer from observed. They arise together. Coral, if you want to, yeah.
Sorry, I'm like,
No,
oh,
I
I should
know.
stop talking. But that's and that gets into the equality thing. Is it's both. And that's why, we want to get at that Kai thing, right? That's like, since it's both, the self and equals the universe. Like they're not mutually exclusive. It's the same thing and they're equal. And yeah. And like I think about like big mind equals small mind. They're
Yeah.
both important. They're both around and they're both real. Anyway, thanks, Mick.
Yeah. That's what and that was my like realization about my filing cabinet was that my filing cabinet is pulling me into existence too, right? Like I don't exist without it. Yeah, we're connected in that way. Okay, well, it is past time, so I will do our dedication. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank
Thank
you,
you, Mick.
friends.
Excellent talk. That
Thank
was
you.
awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye.